The Guardian. Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Nell Bowes. Coming up on the show.
And if you remember in H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, the thing that killed the Martians was bacteria, not lasers or fancy guns or anything like that. It was bacteria because their immune system could not cope.
Chair of the Royal Institution and one of the UK's most eminent scientists, Sir Richard Sykes, joins us to discuss our endless fight with bacteria. We ask Sir Richard if it's truly a losing battle. And from a battle we might win to one we never can. We'll be hearing about a time-eating clock called the chronophage, the creation of Dr. John Taylor, that has taken pride of place alongside Harrison's clock at the Science Museum. Also joining me in the studio to cast an eye across the week's science news will be Guardian science writer Ian Sample and a new addition, our environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Now, for the past 3.5 billion years, bacterial life has been evolving on this planet. You might call them the most adaptable organisms on Earth. They thrive in places from hydrothermal vents to our own internal organs. But it was only in the late 19th century that we had any inkling of what microbes were and, more importantly, how they related to infectious disease. Exploring our battle with microbes, and in particular the alarming growth in resistance to antibiotics, we have the present chair of the Royal Institution, Sir Richard Sykes. He is presenting an overview of more than 70 years of scientific attempts to keep microbes at bay in a lecture called The Evolution of Antimicrobial Resistance. He's giving it on May the 6th at the Royal Institution in London, but I'm delighted to say that he's joining me in the studio to give us a preview. Welcome to Science Weekly, Sir Richard.
Thank you.
Now, it's very nice to have you here. It also feels quite timely. We've had World Health Day earlier this month, which focused on antibiotic resistance, and that recent paper in the Lancet about the sort of rise of a superbug in Delhi. It's a topic that people have been exercised by for quite some time, but what kind of crisis do you think we're facing?
Well, I think it's a very serious crisis, and it's been building up over many years. We got to a point in the 60s and 70s where people really did believe that we conquered the microbial world, we conquered infectious diseases, and they were something that we didn't really have to worry about anymore. And really, nothing could be further from the truth. This is a very serious problem. And, of course, it's getting worse all the time because we're getting fewer and fewer new agents and we're getting more and more resistance. So, at the moment, the bacteria are winning.
So, talk us through, why is it harder to find these new antibiotic agents? What's the problem with the process there?
Well, I think it's that there are many factors that lead to this. First of all, it may not be very difficult to find them, but the effort that's going into finding them has decreased dramatically. So if you go back to the golden era of antibiotic discovery, following the discovery of penicillin, so we're talking about the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, when lots of new classes of antibiotics were discovered, synthetic analogues were made of those. But if you go back now over the last 20 years, the regulatory agencies have made it much more difficult to get new antibiotics onto the market. It's very expensive process, and pharmaceutical companies working in this area have diverted into other areas like cardiovascular, CNS, and areas where probably they make a lot more money at the end of the day than they would working in an area which the regulatory agencies make quite difficult.
And you're speaking as a former chairman of GlaxoSmithKline, aren't you? So is there anything, having seen it from inside, that you think that we should be doing? Is there a different form of regulation we should be looking at? Are there incentives that we should be giving to private industry? How might it work?
I think governments need to understand that this is a very serious problem. We are very susceptible as a race to infectious diseases. So we've been at war with microorganisms since the mid-1930s. And so they have fought back, and they're in a much better position to fight back. And if you remember in H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds, the thing that killed the Martians was bacteria, not lasers or fancy guns or anything like that. It was bacteria because their immune system could not cope with microorganisms.
Is there anything on the horizon that would have the effect of the kind of the discovery of antibiotics in the 1930s and 40s. Is there anything that has that potential at the moment?
No. And of course, we've changed the environmental situation. We've changed demographics. People now travel much more widely than they ever did before. Population size has increased dramatically, and that's what organisms love. They love to move around in populations. And so that also makes a very difficult situation.
And so what are you... Is there anything that you would like to do about it? Is there... I mean, I know that you're... chairman of reform of the think tank. Do you think there are things that you could bring to bear to try and improve our situation?
Well, I think the Infectious Disease Society, the British Society for Antimicrobial Chemotherapy, are constantly working on this issue. They're constantly trying to bring it to people's attention. And I'm sure that's true of the infectious disease societies in America and other parts of the world. And it's only when, of course, we see flesh-eating bacteria and superbugs in Delhi that for a moment the press gets interested, and then it's all gone again and nobody cares until lots of people die. But we've had situations, and we've seen pandemics of flu, which can wipe out hundreds of millions of people. And that is still a possibility today. You only need a few mutations in some of these organisms to create global havoc. We've got to understand how these organisms are developing the resistance, how they're spreading, and how we can prevent the spread. So in hospitals today, the two big issues are methicillin-resistant staphylococci and Clostridium difficile. And if you look at what's happened over the last 10 years in the hospitals in this country, we have reduced the rate of infection from those two organisms quite significantly by good hygiene, by screening patients as they come in to make sure they're not carriers. And so it's those sorts of things that actually help you to prevent these organisms gaining a foothold. Because if you didn't do that, then everybody that went into hospital would get MRSA and they get Clostridium and all sorts of nasty organisms.
You can slow the spread, but
inevitable
process.
You can keep
process.
It under control, and I think that's the critical thing. Prevention is certainly better than cure.
So you've taken over as chair of the Royal Institution. Tell us a bit about what the IRA is doing these days.
Well, I think first of all, you've got to try and understand why the Royal Institution was set up in the first place. It spun out of the Royal Society in 1799 because a lot of eminent people at that time were concerned of the development of science and technology. It might cause unrest amongst the general public if they didn't really have some understanding that it wasn't black magic, but there was some fact behind it all. Today, what the role of the Royal Institution is really, again, an institution to disseminate knowledge, particularly in science and technology and mathematics, to young people, to get young people involved, hopefully also to educate teachers in how to teach science and technology and the history of science and technology. So its mission really hasn't changed, but of course it's in a different context than it would have been 200 years ago.
Do you think we teach science well these days?
No. I think we teach it extremely badly and for all sorts of reasons, because science, mathematics, technology, it's like learning a musical instrument. You've got to work at it. You've got to be enthused. You've got to have people that can really get you involved and understand the great advantages of being involved in science and technology. And there's not enough of that goes on. A lot of it is theory as opposed to practical. These are practical subjects. People need to be doing something to see what's happening, rather than just being given the theory, because that can be very boring and that turns a lot of people.
Is that quite expensive in terms of equipment?
And very expensive, absolutely right.
My thanks to Richard Sykes there, and for information on how to book tickets for his lecture at the Royal Institution in London, just go to their website. That's rigb.org. Now, to take a look at some of the week's big science stories, I'm joined by Guardian science writer Ian Sample and our new environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. Hey, Ian.
Hello.
Hi, Fiona.
Hello.
Brilliant to have you here. So everyone's brought a story along to discuss. I picked something from a paper published in Biology Letters last week, which was just a rather heartening story, actually. This is this old idea around that human babies are born backwards, and this is a rather unusual, unique thing, and is a possibly a reason why the practice of midwifery emerged. And it's something that's sort of been doing the rounds, but nobody's actually spent a lot of time looking at the birth process in other species such as chimpanzees. And this group in Tomano in Japan have just published a paper that looks at chimp birthing and discovers that chimp babies come out backwards in exactly the same way that human babies do, except that chimps don't have a practice of midwifery. They tend to go off and be incredibly private about this. And it's just, I rather liked it as a story because the originator of this idea, Wendy Trevithan, was so remarkably gracious about the fact that this data had come to light and sort of just said, brilliant, so glad somebody's actually checked. It's kind of nice. Did you see it, Ian?
I did, and what I liked about it is this was yet another example of humans being brought up on their assumption that humans are special. It's like yet another example of how, as much as we might like to think we're special, and let's face it, we are special, but in this case, we're not. That chimps are having their babies in a similar way in this one respect, at least, to humans. Now, you could ask the question, well, if this isn't the cause of midwifery in humans, you know, you could also ask, why haven't chimps developed midwifery? I think it comes down to the basics, that they just probably aren't bright enough to have done it and don't have any sort of financial system going on.
You need a financial system rather than a social structure.
Well, you either need some strong altruistic reason to do this.
You've got group behavioural.
Absolutely. Yeah. So that could be a player. But if you don't have that, then you probably need something more along the lines of what we have, where basically you need hard cash so you can pay your rent to bring more people into being midwifery. This is my uneducated
Fiona
response.
Do you want to jump in and quash Ian?
Well, I'm just astonished that it's taken so long to find this out. You know, I mean, you know, it's been there the whole time, and chimps have been studied for years and years. Why did no one notice this before?
Well, this is extraordinary. The team that were much closer to the chimps than other researchers have been, they actually slept in the enclosure every night, which was part of the reason why they were able to get so close, and because it has been a very kind of private process, and chimps, you know, go off and do it alone, and so it's actually quite hard to get close enough to see the details of what's going on.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Well, I liked it. What have you got? What on your plate, Ian?
Well, my story is about a debate going on in the UK at the moment about whether there should be a law change to allow a technique that would treat mitochondrial diseases in babies. Now, there's essentially a group of diseases that are caused by genetic defects in mitochondria. Now, mitochondria are the little organelles that you get in cells. They're actually in the cell cytoplasm, the sort of the bit around the nucleus. And you can get defects in those that can affect the sort of the way the cells use and generate energy. Now, if you pick up one of these diseases, and they obviously run down the female line because mitochondria are inherited through the egg along the female line, those diseases can cause all manner of serious problems. You can end up with blindness, organ failure, muscle disorders, and learning disabilities, an incredibly wide range of conditions that they cause. Now,
but you're not talking about treating mitochondrial disease in an existing fetus. You're talking about an IVF process that would create a viable fetus.
That's right. So what's happened at the moment is a lot of scientific research has been done in animals to show that there are techniques that you can use to try and cure this. And essentially what you end up doing is you take an egg from a female that has the mitochondrial disease, the egg that would go on to give rise to the baby. Now you want to swap the mitochondria for healthy ones, essentially. So what you can do is take the nucleus out, drop it into a donor egg that has healthy mitochondria that's had its own nucleus removed, fuse that egg, and then fertilize it. Now, this has worked in animals. It's experimental. You need to do an awful lot more checking to make sure it would be safe to do in humans, but it is a way of treating this condition or this range of conditions that there is no other way of doing it. And you do have to do it at the IVF stage. Now, the debate in the UK at the moment is there are medical organisations like the Wellcome Trust, the Medical Research Council, saying that we need to really think about a change in the law now so that a few years down the line, when all the checks have been put in place to make sure this technique is safe, we can then bring it to clinic very early and we don't get to the stage where we know it's safe, but it takes years and years to get any legal changes so you can use it.
So what are the objections to it? Is this the kind of the idea of the third parent?
There are people who react to a sort of misplaced ickiness over this, because what you end up with is the fertilized egg that turns into the embryo will correctly have some DNA from three people. So you have the father's DNA, the mother's DNA, but the DNA in the mitochondria, which are just these little bits that stick around the nucleus, are from a donor. Now, the important thing to realize is, although that's a tiny amount of DNA going into the offspring, that DNA doesn't shape how you look or anything. I mean, this isn't, the nuclear DNA is essentially what gives you your shape and stuff like that, if you like, the developmental part of you. The mitochondrial DNA really is just how well those cells function. And if they are damaged, then they won't function very well. But you're not changing the person with that DNA. You're just curing a very awful disease. And I can't see a valid argument against it, personally.
Can I just ask whether there are any possible dangers to this? I mean, you know, could you get it wrong?
Undoubtedly. As soon as you start doing techniques which involve pulling apart fertilized eggs in some cases, or unfertilized eggs and mixing them around, there is a capacity to introduce problems, undoubtedly. Now, people already think that you may be picking up a slight increase in certain abnormality through standard IVF, for example. So, and that's because you, instead of the egg maturing in the body, it matures in a dish. And so these subtle differences can possibly give rise to like a really tiny increase in certain abnormalities. Now, doing something like this, yes, the scope is there for it to be causing, you know, other problems that we don't pick up until further down the line. And that's exactly the kind of research that needs to be done to make sure it's safe enough to start looking at doing in humans.
And on to our last story. Gas shale exploration has moved at a rapid pace in the US, in part due to the need for energy security. But the processes used to get it out of the ground are proving highly controversial. Fiona, you're doing a series on this. Can you tell us a bit about it?
Well, shale gas has become accessible really because of advances in a technique known as fracking, fracturing the rock. The shale rock is very sort of dense. It's you know, it's millions of years old. To look at it, you wouldn't have any idea that there was gas trapped inside it, but there is, in tiny, tiny bubbles. And so in order to release the gas, methane essentially, you need to blow this rock apart. You create tiny, tiny fissures in it, which are big enough just to release tiny bubbles of the natural gas, which then bubble up towards the surface, and you can collect them and you can siphon them off and use them in the way that you would gas, that you would any kind of
that
gas.
You use natural gas or anything.
Exactly. You can use it for, you know, for generating electricity, or you can use it for heating, or, you know, any of those uses of the fuel. But the process, that process of opening these tiny fissures, requires you to blast this rock, which is thousands of feet usually below the surface, to blast it with a mixture of water, sand, and chemicals, which, you know, then have to go somewhere. These chemicals in the UK, we know what the chemicals being used are because we have strong regulations. In the US, you're not allowed to know what the chemicals are. This is because of a law, it's a legal loophole that was opened up by President Bush and his vice president, Dick Cheney, who was a former chief of a company that did this kind of thing. And as a result of that loophole, hundreds of chemicals can be used, and some of them could be really quite nasty. There's been evidence found of the use of benzene, of lead, of diesel oil. There's been chemicals like instant coffee, would you believe?
So they're blasting this rock deep down with this stuff. It's not a mechanical process, is it? It's a chemical process.
Well, it's mechanical and chemical, because you need to drill right down.
Yeah.
And this is the source of some of the problems, because you need to drill. Often you will drill through aquifers, you know, where people get their drinking water from. You need to drill through other layers of rock until you get to the shale, the gas-bearing shale. And you need to drill a lot of these holes. In the UK, they're talking about drilling maybe 8 per square mile in the areas we're talking about. So, you know, you can imagine that's quite a high density of holes that you've got to drill. One of the problems, particularly in the US, is that the the wells that are being drilled are not necessarily safe. You've got to encase the hole that you're drilling in concrete. And if that
how big is one of these holes?
I've been to see them. It's they don't have to be that big. I mean, you can have drill bits that are only maybe 18 inches across, but you do need quite a lot of them if you're drilling horizontally. And then the other issue is that once you get to a certain depth into the shale, in the US it's very common once you've drilled down to then drill across through the shale, and that can generate problems as well. And it's very difficult to ensure that those wells are being drilled safely.
Are you talking about the structural integrity of things above those wells? I mean, what sort of geographical distribution are we talking about? Where is
well,
this happening?
Well, in the US, there's a lot of this stuff. There's,
Does it happen solely in unpopulated areas, or is it?
No, this is the thing. It's happening in densely populated areas as well. There are plans, for instance, to drill in New York State. Those plans have been stopped because of a local outcry. But there's other areas in the US. There, Pittsburgh, for instance. A lot of people in that area think that their water supply has been badly contaminated by this drilling process. In other areas, you've got problems with the seismic
effects
disturbance.
Of this kind of disturbance.
Yeah, because you're drilling a long way down and then you're drilling across and so on. And it's very difficult to say whether these wells, the drilling of these wells and the fracturing of these rocks is causing the seismic disturbances that we're seeing.
I was going to say, how much evidence have we accumulated so far of the actual bad effects?
Well, this is the thing. Because of the legal loopholes, it's very difficult to keep an eye on these things. So academics have been doing studies for a few years now, but there hasn't really been adequate legal supervision. And this is in part because the US Environmental Protection Agency was essentially the legal loopholes stripped them of a lot of their powers to intervene. Now, that's being remedied. The EPA is now undertaking a massive piece of research that should answer many of these questions, and you know, we should find out a lot more about, you know, how safe or unsafe these things are. But unfortunately, we won't get the results of that till 2014.
Goodness. Ian, what do you want to know?
Fiona, I was interested in your piece last week that was making the point that a lot of the gas companies are promoting this as a green fuel.
Yeah. The reason that this fossil fuel can be rebranded as green is because when you burn gas, pure gas, in a power station, it generates about half of the carbon dioxide emissions that you would get if you burned coal. Now, that's a saving. I mean, you know, in the UK, for instance, we had a dash for gas in the 80s and 90s, and that was the source of a lot of the reductions in greenhouse gases that you saw in the UK. However, shale gas is rather different because, you know, this process that you go through of, you know, blasting these rocks and so on results in leakage of the methane. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So there's been a study, it's just been published by Cornell University, which has found that actually when you add up all the methane losses and the extra energy used and so on, that using shale gas to generate electricity is actually pretty much exactly the same as using coal in terms of the carbon output. So it's not really a green fuel at all.
And how's your feeling on whether the governments and basically those people who are going to either endorse or not endorse gas shell, I mean, what's your feeling on their view of this? Are they being won over by the idea that it is actually green fuel, or are they buying into that?
Well, it comes down to cost in the end, and particularly in the US, because shale gas is in such abundance around the world that if it can be exploited successfully, and we've seen it being exploited in the US, then it will be a very cheap source of fuel, much cheaper, for instance, than renewables, but not if you take the carbon into account. And so you've got this kind of war going on where the gas companies are saying, you know, it is a green fuel. They're basing it on a comparison, an outdated now comparison with coal. They're saying it's cheap. They're saying it improves energy security in the US because it's, you know, it's there. You don't need to import it from the Middle East. And in Europe, the same argument is going on. We've uncovered a lot of evidence of lobbying going on at very high levels within the European Union. And, you know, this is a kind of battle for hearts and minds, because if the gas industry is successful in persuading governments that this is a green fuel, then what you'll see is an awful lot more gas-fired power stations being built. And those power stations will have a life of between 25 and, you know, perhaps 40 years that they could still be there. And then they will be spewing out carbon dioxide at an enormous rate throughout those decades. And that will mean that we won't be able to meet our climate change targets.
How are events in Japan playing into this with the knock that's been dealt to nuclear power over there, which has obviously had knock-on effects around Europe?
This has had a huge effect. Essentially, you could characterise the situation previously to a kind of three-horse race. You had gas, renewable energy and nuclear power vying to be the source of relatively low-carbon energy. Now what's happened is that the problems with Fukushima in Japan have made people very unsettled, quite rightly, about nuclear power. It's raised an awful lot of questions. And that means that, you know, if nuclear power is no longer seen as a safe option, then this effectively becomes a two-horse race between gas and renewables. And the gas industry is going all out to make sure it's them and not renewables. And they've got a lot more money than the renewable industry.
Fiona, thank you for talking us through all of that. You can find Fiona Harvey's series of articles on the gas shale on guardian.co.uk/environment. Thanks also to Ian Sample for being in the pod today. You can read the rest of his stuff on guardian.co.uk/science. Now it's that time in the podcast where we ask the Hannaford question of a leading scientist. For those who are not regular listeners, you might ask, what on earth is that? Well, our loyal listener, Rob Hannaford, requested that we ask all our guests the same question. If you had one question in the universe that you could have answered, what would it be?
Hi, I'm Brian Green, Professor of Physics and Mathematics at Columbia University. And one question that I would love to have the answer to is, what is the true nature of time? Time is something that governs our lives. It's what gives us a poignancy to existence. What is time? Where did it come from? Is it made of something finer, just like a table is made up of molecules and atoms? Is time made up of some sort of atoms of time? That is the question that I'd love to have an answer to.
An excellent question on the nature of time there, and a perfect thought to ponder as we explore John Taylor's timepiece, the chronophage. It's a unique handmade mechanical clock which has taken pride of place in the Science Museum, next to Harrison's clock, the greatest clock in maritime history. Rebecca Hill went along to find out more.
I'm here at the Science Museum in London, and I've come to the opening of a new display at the Science Museum, which is showing the time-eating clock, or the chronophage. And it's an absolutely amazing invention. It's a really large grasshopper on top of a large gold circle, and it's got lots of implosions on it. It looks like if you drop a stone into water, but on its side is the best way to describe it. And actually, this was created by underwater explosions, and that's how they got it to, that's how they got the metal into the shape. And underneath there's a very large circular pendulum with a smaller circle underneath it. And as the seconds tick by, the grasshopper's mouth gets bigger and bigger and more open. And as the end of the minute approaches, it snaps its mouth shut. And that's the idea behind it being a time-eating clock. So it's very impressive. And I've come here to talk to the inventor of the clock, who's inspired by John Harrison, who created the very first maritime clock. It was the first clock to measure time accurately at sea, which was very important in those days. That was his inspiration behind making this clock. And I've come to talk to him today.
As an inventor, I never liked to do anything that anybody else has done, so I wanted to create a clock which was a homage to John Harrison. And the reason why I have two reasons to be in awe of John Harrison is, first of all, I spent all my life designing bimetal controls for electric kettles. So if you've got an electric kettle at home, yes, there's a 75% chance that it'll have one of my controls inside it. And inside the control are little snap-action bimetal pieces. And who invented bimetal? John Harrison. And he invented the bimetal for temperature compensation of sea clocks. And he invented the first sea clock that could keep accurate time and give you your longitude. And I love flying, and all navigation comes back to time, and so that all my navigation, I'm indebted to John Harrison, as is every traveler who flies in an airplane. So when I wanted to make a homage to John Harrison, that's the reason the clock has a grasshopper escapement, which he also invented.
So what's an escapement, exactly?
The escapement, a complicated question. It's the link between the timekeeping mechanism, the pendulum, and the power that's stored in the spring or the weight. And it has to do two things. The escapement has to respond to the pendulum to release on each tick of the clock, a second moves forward on the dial. But the escapement also has to keep the pendulum running, because with friction and air resistance, it would slow down. So it has to give it a small impulse every click of the pendulum, and that's what the escapement does. And John Harrison invented an escapement with no friction, because in the 18th century, the biggest problem in a clock was lubrication, because oils were very limited. Linseed oil, for example, well, you make paint out of it, it dries. Goose grease, it's lovely slippery stuff, but in winter it gets quite hard. So that the oils were available were very, very limited, and they were the Achilles heel of all clocks, because they were either too thick or too thin, and this changed the timekeeping of a clock. And particularly if you're trying to do a sea clock where you were going through the tropics and to the cold regions, one clock had to be accurate in all those cases. So oil was the problem. Harrison designed an escapement with no oil.
Great. And could you just tell me a little bit about why the clock's called a chronophage?
Well, yes, when you get to my age, you realise time is not on your side. It's the enemy. So much to do and so little time left. And so I had the concept and invention of making a clock eat time. And on the 59th second of every minute, during the minute he's opened his mouth and it gets wider and wider and wider and wider, and then on the 59th second he goes and he snaps his jaw and he eats that minute, chews it up, and you can never get it back. So don't waste time.
And is that when all the lights start flashing around, because there's lots of lights all over the clock, isn't there? Is that when...
Yes. The seconds, time seems to be racing away. And instead of just showing the seconds 1, 2, 3, which is fairly boring, the seconds race around the dial and just pause. And so it goes all the way around the dial. So it goes 1 and then all the way around to 2 and then all the way around to 3 and all the way around to 4. So you see time racing away before your eyes. And it gives a visual indication that time is racing away all the time. Don't waste it.
Fantastic. And it's absolutely huge. It's much bigger than I expected it to be. It must have taken a long time to build.
Indeed it did. We made a half-size prototype, and we had a lot of problems with that because it just didn't work. Because the escapement, which I've mentioned, instead of being the size of a 50p piece inside a Harrison clock, as you can see here, it's 4'6", a metre and a half in diameter. And it's a true mechanical clock, and the spring driving it, it had this huge inertia of the big escape wheel. And then that was giving a huge impulse, and the pendulum went faster and faster and beating wider and wider amplitude until it was damaging itself. And we had a disaster. It didn't work. So when you have a disaster and you're an inventor, there are three things you can do. Give up, try to design around it, or say, well, we've got something that's very bad. How can we turn that into an advantage? And so because the the pendulum was increasing in amplitude. I thought, well, if we control the amplitude, we can stop that. What advantage can we get? Well, we can control the period, and that's the time of the pendulum. Then we can make the clock run fast, we can make it run slow, we can make it do tricks. And if you stop and watch it, it'll do just that, because that's what time does. And Einstein said time's relative, and he was then asked for an example. And the example he gave was that, then, well, just think of it. He said, an hour sat on a park bench with a pretty girl passes in a moment. But a moment sat on a hot stove seems like an hour. So time, it isn't regular in one's lives. It is relative to the situation you're in. And this is the first clock in the world which tells relative time, because it runs fast and it runs slow, and it fits in with your life, and it shows that time isn't regular and it's going too fast, and don't waste it.
And for more information on how you can go along and see the impressive time-eating machine, visit the Science Museum's website. That's sciencemuseum.org.uk. Well, that's all we have for you this week on Science Weekly. So from me, Nell Bowes, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.